This is Audible.
Shakespeare appreciated a full cast performance and guided analysis of William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, a SmartPass production.
It is September the 8th, 1601. We are in Holy Trinity Church, Stratford, at the funeral of a man who had at one time played an important role in the community. As a craftsman, he made some of the finest gloves from this part of the world. And as a townsman, some 30 years ago, he held the position of mayor. During the intervening years, he fell from grace and lived through some difficult times. But just recently, his importance in the town was re-established, largely due to the success of his son in London. His name is John Shakespeare, and his only surviving son, William, stands at his graveside. William Shakespeare is 37 years old, an actor, writer, and part owner of the most prestigious theatre in the capital. He often performs for the Queen herself. As William sprinkles earth onto his father's casket, his mind is reeling. This is the end of an era, the end of his family name. His father is gone, and his own child, his son and heir, is buried close by. At this time, another important passing is inevitable, as after 43 years on the throne, Queen Elizabeth I is sick and old. While her death doesn't affect him personally, creatively it touches him very deeply, and it clearly stirs the nation. Elizabeth came to the throne at a difficult time for England. She succeeded her sister Mary, named Bloody Mary for the slaughter she allowed in the name of Catholicism. Their father, Henry VIII, had been so desperate for a male heir that he broke England away from the Roman Catholic Church and formed his own. You see, his wife couldn't bear him a child, and the Roman Catholic faith condemned divorce, so he created a church that would allow him to divorce and remarry. When Mary came to the throne, she attempted to undo some of her father's work and return England to the Catholic Church. Much of what she did or allowed to be done in her name was orchestrated by her husband, Philip II, King of Spain, and, of course, a Catholic. Had Mary lived, England would almost certainly have returned to the Roman Catholic fold. But she ruled for just 5 years and died childless of tuberculosis in 1558. This brought her sister Elizabeth to the throne. A very different woman and a very different monarch. She wanted to rule the country, her country, as she saw fit. She would not relinquish any of her power, and so never married, as that would have meant passing the leadership of the country to her husband. She also ended the slide towards Roman Catholicism and kept firmly to her father's wishes for the church in England. The early years of her reign were bumpy, and she was the target of assassination attempts. She was excommunicated from the church, expelled from the Roman Catholic family by the Vatican, and in 1570 the Pope announced that any successful assassin would be absolved of his sin. This was nothing short of putting a bounty on her head. Spain, furious at losing their control over England, tried to invade in 1588. They attacked with their armada, or naval force, but the English, although smaller in number, held their own, and, inspired by their queen, were victorious.
Come over the bourne, Bessie. Come over the bourne, Bessie.
That within the body of a weak and feeble woman lies the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England, too.
Before all over that ever I see.
Yet here in 1601, more than a decade later, Elizabeth's glory is somewhat tarnished because she is near death and the golden age of her reign is in jeopardy.
with no direct heir to continue her work. Factions move against her, and there are threats of civil war, of Catholics and Protestants fighting for control. This fear and insecurity permeates the streets. It's what everybody's talking about. One of Shakespeare's greatest strengths as a writer is his ability to tune into the mood of the people, to capture the zeitgeist. And while he wrote for the world he lived in, he created plays that have stood the test of time. But now, as Shakespeare mourns the death of his father, and the situation in England bears down upon him, he is planning, or may have even already begun, to write his next play with a lighter touch, a comedy. In the January of 1601, the seeds for Twelfth Night may have been planted when Shakespeare's troupe performed before the Queen and her honoured guest, Virginio Orsino, the Duke of Bracciano, who has identical twin children, a boy and a girl. The entertainments took place on Epiphany, the twelfth night after Christmas, which, according to Christianity, was when three wise kings arrived to bless the baby Jesus and revealed him to be the Son of God. Previously, this time had been important to the pagan religions, the ancient religious movements before Christianity, who saw this time as marking the death of the old year and the beginning of the new. So, Shakespeare leaves his father's graveside and returns home to work on Twelfth Night. Shakespeare would know that he's approaching London, not just from the familiar landscape, but by the growing stench emanating from the city. London is a city where disease is rife, where there is no electricity, no gas, antibiotics, plumbing. Waste, including human waste, is thrown out into the streets or dumped into the River Thames. The air reeks. Children are lucky to live to their eighth birthday. And to reach 50 years of age is a great achievement. Disease, especially plague, is an almost constant threat. But it's home to Shakespeare. It's where he belongs. It's also home to the Globe Theatre that 2 years earlier he helped to build on the south bank of the River Thames. Before we reach the city, let me tell you more about Shakespeare and the time in which he lived. William Shakespeare was born in 1564 in Stratford, Warwickshire. That we know, though much of his early life is shrouded in mystery, as record-keeping was pretty hit and miss back then. Over the years, the large gaps in Shakespeare's life story have led to much speculation, even suggestions that he may not have written all the plays credited to his name. This theorising has particularly come about because there are no records to show that he attended school, let alone university. What we do know is that at the age of 18, he married Anne Hathaway, a woman some years older than him, and they had three children. A daughter, Susanna, who was born to them 6 months after a hastily arranged marriage, and then twins, a boy, Hamlet, and a girl, Judith. Then, sometime around 1587, when he was about 23, he travelled to London and entered the life of the theatre. We don't know whether his wife objected or encouraged, if he went with the express intention of writing for the theatre, or whether he just needed to get away from Stratford. Rumour has it that he fled Warwickshire because he was wanted for poaching on a local nobleman's land. There is also the suggestion that on leaving Stratford, he joined a travelling troupe of players he met quite by accident and replaced a young actor killed in a duel. But there's little evidence to support the story. Whatever happened, Shakespeare found himself in London, away from his family, and he looked to the theatre for work. So, why the theatre? Well, as I said, there's no record of Shakespeare having had any formal education, and his father, John Shakespeare, even though he was mayor of Stratford, was illiterate. But so were many people in those days, even men with some power and position. As town alderman and mayor, John Shakespeare would have been responsible for granting licences to touring theatre companies, To qualify for a license, these troops would perform for the council. And it's likely that young Will would have been invited to see these shows, as many as 6 performances before he was 10 years old. This could have been the spark that ignited his imagination, that led him to follow his dreams and leave Stratford, which may well have seemed too small, too dull, and too provincial for the young Shakespeare. It's believed that he started on the lowest rung of the ladder, possibly as an ostler or parking attendant for a wealthy person's horse or carriage, and progressed to minor stage roles, such as second spear carrier from the left, and we can only guess at what these plays were like and what they were about. Performances that the young Will Shakespeare saw with his father in Stratford would have been more or less the same kind of entertainment that had been playing in England since medieval times. Morality plays. They usually featured some archetypical young man who is dragged from the path of righteousness by a charismatic figure and introduced to sex and drugs and rock and roll. Well, in the 16th century sense, of course. And must be returned to the path of good by another figure. Usually hope, or virtue, or some such goodly archetype. But this early theatre was changing, giving way to something new, something more sophisticated and cosmopolitan. Under the rule of Queen Elizabeth, England was growing in confidence and stature. London was becoming a hub of commerce and creativity, and saw a phenomenal growth in population. Not only were men flocking to London from the counties of England, but from all over Europe, and they brought stories, art, and theatre. He arrived in London at an exciting time for theatre. About a decade earlier, in 1576, James Burbage had constructed the first purpose-built playhouse on some derelict land in Shoreditch, just outside the walled city of London, which he proudly called the Theatre. The building was a round structure with a thatched roof that covered the walls, but left a huge gaping area in the centre, open to the elements. Of course, this was to allow light into the building and onto the stage, as before gas and electricity, the only artificial light came from incredibly expensive tapers and candles. And so, public theatre in Shakespeare's time took place only during the day, lit by the sky. The audience was mostly made up of groundlings, who paid a penny to stand in front of the stage and watch the show. And around the walls was more expensive seating for the merchant class and gentry. We're not sure how many people the theatre could hold, but we do know that the Globe, built some 23 years later, had a capacity of almost 2,000. Theatre was hugely popular back then, and it's thought that at least 1/3 of all Londoners went to the theatre once a month or so, which is a lot of people. Theatre in Shakespeare's day was very different to what we know today. Before TV and even newspapers, it was a mass entertainment, not at all elitist or highbrow, and attracted people from all walks of life. People like Burbage understood the need to provide entertainment, and the success of the first playhouse led to more venues opening, such as the Curtain, the Rose, and the Globe. Theatre was very popular, and there was a growing demand for new plays and new playwrights. To satisfy this, a group of writers appeared as if from nowhere with new dramatic works. This cultured crowd of the late 1580s and early 1590s included Christopher Marlowe, Thomas Nash, George Peel, Thomas Watson, and Robert Greene. As a group, they became known as the University Wits, and were all highly educated, intelligent men writing intelligent drama. The young Shakespeare entered this brave new world alongside them, but was never a part of their inner circle. Unlike Shakespeare, they didn't act, direct, or necessarily even like the players who performed their work. For them, it was an intellectual exercise with a pay packet and something of a walk on the wild side. Theatre was considered disreputable and violent. And it was! Shakespeare's great friend and rival, the playwright Christopher Marlowe, was stabbed in the eye and killed in a brawl. And Ben Jonson, author of The Alchemist, killed a man in a duel and was nearly hanged for the crime. While they seemed to burn out and buckle under the pressure, Shakespeare kept on writing, growing, learning, and experimenting. You see, he had a real hunger for the theatre and for the theatricality of performance. He thought like an actor, a writer, and a director.
He wanted to move the audience, to create a reaction. And this is the main reason why he emerged with the greater reputation, the stronger legacy, and the most profound body of work. Although the language of his writing is extraordinary, it is a tool, a device to create a feeling or mood on stage. It's never merely clever for clever's sake, which cannot be said of the university wits. Shakespeare's work was innovative and groundbreaking, because over time he stretched the rules to create a new kind of theatre. Each step of his development as a writer would have been something of a revelation to the Elizabethan audience, who up until this point had only known very simple early theatre. This early theatre developed from sermonising and the oral tradition of storytelling. It rarely used props, scenery or costume, but relied on language to make its point. Even though most Elizabethans were illiterate, they would have known stories from the Bible, as well as classical Greek and Roman mythology. They learned by listening, and so understood and appreciated verse, meter and rhyme, which we're far less familiar with today, and therefore find difficult to get to grips with at times. Early theatre presented stories that the audience already knew in a very simple way. They took place in one geographical location, over one day, and with a single plot line, following a convention known as the unity of time, place and action, a convention that Shakespeare didn't just stretch, but shattered. The scope for female characters was very limited in early theatre, mainly because women were banned from the stage under the orders of the Lord Chamberlain, as acting was seen as a highly disreputable occupation, and certainly not one for a woman. This law stood throughout Shakespeare's lifetime, and it wasn't until 1660, after the restoration of the monarchy, that the first woman was allowed on stage. Audiences in Elizabethan England were used to seeing young men, or ingenues, play young women's parts. Older women were played by men, often for comic effect. You know, some big bear of a man in gaudy makeup and a dress, singing dirty songs and making lewd jokes. Women's roles in early theatre were pretty one-dimensional, progressing the plot or reacting to the men or, of course, being incredibly crude and getting great laughs. In this play, Shakespeare is deliciously subversive, as are identical twins, the sister, Viola, and brother, Sebastian, both played by boys, become the objects of men's and women's desire. At times, it's as if the stage is strewn with lovesick suitors. You see, through Shakespeare's innovation, he created a new kind of theatre, one that is driven not by plot, but by character, by human foibles and desires, by the emotional and psychological needs of men and women. This was hundreds of years before Freud attempted to explore and understand the psyche, yet Shakespeare instinctively knew the human mind and heart. As we approach the city, let's take a good look at Shakespeare. At his father's graveside, we said he'd been largely responsible for John Shakespeare's resurgence in his hometown. Shakespeare has been very successful in London, and much of that has filtered back to Stratford, with Shakespeare buying property in the town and even establishing a coat of arms for his family. At 37 years old, he would have been considered a man of middle to late years, as it was a real achievement to reach the age of 50. He's not only still writing, but performs, and as co-owner of the Globe, is involved in the theatre's administration. In September 1601, he is at the peak of his powers. The Globe opened in 1599 with Henry V, followed by Julius Caesar. His greatest masterpiece, Hamlet, is already under his belt, and he is soon to write three more tragedies that will elevate him to the status of the world's greatest writer in the English language. The plays to come are King Lear, Othello, and Macbeth. And, of course, we are here to experience his finest comedy, Twelfth Night, or to use its subtitle, What You Will. Like most of his work, Twelfth Night is not an original story. Shakespeare found his inspiration from three sources. Firstly, from Ginginati. Shakespeare took elements of this story and combined them with influences from a prose poem by Barnaby Richards, The Tale of Apollonius and Scylla.
Finally, Shakespeare was inspired by Menachmi, a play about twins who fall in love and marry, by the ancient Roman writer Plautus. These source materials create the framework for Twelfth Night, but the brilliance of the play isn't in its story, but in its characters and mood. Twelfth Night is the blackest, saddest, most melancholic of comedies, and of course it is a fin de siècle play about the end of an era. The main action takes place in a transitional time between the old times and the new age, where the normal order of society is out of kilter and the usual rules don't apply. The topsy-turvy world Shakespeare creates for the play is influenced by the Italian tradition of commedia dell'arte. Renowned for its speed of repartee and grotesque characterizations, it uses a series of stock characters and situations, such as clever servants, wise fools, and foolish rulers involved in love, scandal, plotting, trickery, cross-dressing, the outwitting of simpletons, and more than one man falling in love with the same woman. Travelling commedia companies visited London, and Shakespeare would undoubtedly have seen the shows and met the performers. Their influences and ideas make Twelfth Night the most European of his comedies, as it is fantastically subversive, very theatrical, and while Shakespeare doesn't have his characters wear the masks of traditional commedia, we do see men become women, servants become cunning manipulators, and fools become sages. In this play, Shakespeare presents one of his most complex characters, the Puritan Malvolio, who is not a villain, but a self-deceiver, a shallow and ambitious man with no compassion and no redeeming qualities. Puritanism was the term used to define the movement growing during Elizabeth's reign that denounced all religious ornamentation and excess. Puritans were fundamentalists who believed the Bible as literal truth, wanted a no-frills church, were against science and technology, and wanted mankind to adhere to dour Christian values. They considered colour and entertainment to be unnecessary and dangerous, and they were utterly despised by Shakespeare and his theatrical brotherhood. For if the Puritans had their way, theatres would close down forever, and all the fun would be sucked out of life. Now, I told you that Twelfth Night was the twelfth night after Christmas, or Epiphany. That last day of Christmas, which in the ancient days was the pagan winter festival. Epiphany was originally a major Christian feast, even more important than Christmas, because it commemorated the coming of the Magi, the three wise men or kings who gave Jesus gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh. Now, in the pagan calendar, this time was one where everything was dying and new seeds were planted. A time for fun and partying before the hard work of the new year. Of course, these pagan practices were seen as undesirable during the Middle Ages, when the church tried to suppress or stop this annual party time. So Twelfth Night as a play represents this battle between excess and Puritanism, but also exists in a sort of mad time, where normal rules don't apply and misrule is allowed to break in and make strange things happen. The world is topsy-turvy, upside down, and it's possible to play tricks on people. By the way, Twelfth Night used to be known as the Feast of Fools, and the play Twelfth Night certainly is a feast of fools and foolish behaviour. Of course, with Elizabeth in the last months of her reign, it was possible that Puritans could gain power under the new monarch. But London was becoming a cosmopolitan city, a magnet for the riches of the world, and its populace didn't want to go backwards, but forwards. Earlier, we said that Shakespeare reflects the mood of the people, and in Twelfth Night, he clearly responds to his own time, to his London in particular, and to its people, as he taps into the gossip, the rumours, and the insecurity of the age, as people feared the aftermath of Elizabeth's death. Earlier, I said that Shakespeare created theatre based upon psychology and an understanding of the human mind, hundreds of years before there was any scientific exploration of the human psyche. Shakespeare understood life, understood pain, loss, and ambition, and developed his writing to communicate this insight with the audience so that they cared, listened, and understood what they were witnessing on the stage before them. Today, Shakespeare is loved mostly for his tragedies, for Hamlet and King Lear, Othello and Macbeth, for these giants of men who open their hearts and minds for us. But in Twelfth Night, we have an ensemble cast, and so many of the characters could be the centre of their own play. It's full of loss, hope, despair, unrequited love, betrayal, and it's a comedy. The granddaddy of black comedy. Twelfth Night, or What You Will. As a group of musicians plays, their master, Count Orsino, sweeps onto the stage, followed by his attendant, Curio, and an entourage of courtiers and lords.
Oh, if music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiting the appetite may sicken and so die.
The first three lines, and already we see that Duke Orsino is a melancholic man, in love and wearing it on his sleeve for all the world to see. He says that if music was love, he would eat all he possibly could, just stuff himself until he ate so much he would die. He seems to be in love with the idea of love, the concept of love, rather than any particular person. He is in love with love. Then he listens to the tune itself. He knows it well.
That strain again. It had a dying fall. Oh, it came o'er my ear like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing and giving odour. Enough, no more.
And the musicians stop dead. They know that Orsino means stop when he says it.
'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. Oh, spirit of love. How quick and fresh art thou, that notwithstanding thy capacity receiveth as the sea, nought enters there of what validity and pitch soe'er, but falls into abatement and low price even in a minute. So full of shapes is fancy that it alone is high fantastical.
So love is strange. It comes in many shapes and sizes, is fantastical or otherworldly, and cannot be tamed. This description of love sets the tone of the play and prepares the audience for what's to come. Keen to distract his master from the spirit of love that taunts him, Curio suggests that Orsino goes hunting.
Will he go hunt, my lord?
What, Curio?
The heart.
Why, so I do. The noblest that I have.
Curio means heart, H-A-R-T, or a deer to hunt. But Orsino has a one-track mind, as he is hunting a heart, H-E-A-R-T. He is madly in love.
Oh, when mine eyes did see Olivia first, methought she purged the air of pestilence.
Meaning that she was so gorgeous and good that she cured the plague.
That instant was I turned into a heart, and my desires like fell and cruel hounds e'er since pursue me.
This is a reference to Diana and Actaeon. The story goes that Diana, Roman goddess of the moon and an eternal teenager, was bathing in a moonlit pool, and Actaeon caught a glimpse of her naked beauty. Fearing that he would talk of what he'd seen, Diana turned him into a stag, and he was ripped apart by his own hunting dogs. Enter Valentine. Orsino has sent this trusted man to visit Olivia and plead with her to marry, or at least meet, Orsino. So when Orsino sees him, he leaps up with great hope.
How now? What news from her?
So please, my lord, I might not be admitted.
Ooh, bad news. She wouldn't let him in to see her.
But from her handmaid do return this answer. The element itself, till 7 years hence, shall not behold her face at ample view, but like a cloistress she will veiled walk, and water once a day her chamber round with eye-offending brine. All this to season a dead brother's love, which she would keep fresh and lasting in her sad remembrance.
So the element, or the sky, will not see her face for 7 years, because like a nun, or cloistress, she will cover her face with a veil and weep for the loss of her brother. Orsino has fallen for a woman who's not only in mourning, but is dedicated, almost addicted, to her grief.
Oh, she that hath a heart of that fine frame to pay this debt of love but to a brother! How will she love when the rich golden shaft hath killed the flock of all affections else that live in her? When liver, brain, and heart, these sovereign thrones are all supplied and filled, her sweet perfections with one self-king.
Orsino doesn't care that she's grieving. He focuses on the idea that if she can love a brother so deeply, just imagine how she could love a man romantically and sexually. The rich golden shaft is obviously his penis, and Orsino says that his sexual prowess will make her bow to him and no other. He will rule her body and soul, her liver, brain and heart. Elizabethans believed the human passions were ruled from the liver as the source of blood. Judgments came from the brain and sentiment from the heart. These are the three ruling facets of a human being, which is what he means by these sovereign thrones. Liver, brain, heart, passion, judgment, sentiment.
Away, before me to sweet beds of flowers. Love thoughts lie rich when canopied with bowers.
And with that, he heads off to his garden to fantasize about Olivia. And scene one comes to an end. Act one, scene two. We are at the coast, after a terrible shipwreck that has left few survivors. The remains of the ship has washed ashore, along with a few sailors, the ship's captain, and a young woman of about 16, Viola.
What country, friends, is this?
This is Illyria, lady.
Illyria is near Italy, and at the time would have been ruled by Venice. It's unlikely that Shakespeare had ever been there, but he does have his geography right, unlike coastal scenes in some of his other plays.
What should I do in Illyria? My brother, he is in Elysium.
Elysium is another word for heaven. So Viola thinks her brother Sebastian may be dead.
Perchance he is not drowned. What think you, sailors?
It is perchance that you yourself were saved.
It was only chance that Viola was saved.
Oh, my poor brother. And so perchance may he be.
She's optimistic. She survived, so why not him too?
True, madam. And to comfort you with chance, assure yourself, after our ship did split, when you and those poor numbers saved with you hung on our driving boat, I saw your brother, most confident in peril, bind himself, courage and hope both teaching him the practice, to a strong mast that lived upon the sea, where, like Arion on the dolphin's back, I saw him old acquaintance with the waves, so long as I could see.
Sebastian was last seen by the captain, strapping himself to a mast, so it's possible that, like Arion, he escaped death. Arion was a musician in Greek legend who leapt overboard to escape being murdered and was rescued by a dolphin which he rowed safely to the shore.
For saying so, there's gold.
She gives the captain gold. In Shakespeare's day, women would not generally carry money, so this is not just a gesture of generosity, but a very masculine thing to do.
Mine own escape unfoldeth to my hope, whereto thy speech serves for authority, the like of him.
If I escaped a watery grave, he might have too.
Knowest thou this country?
Aye, madam, well, for I was bred and born, not 3 hours' travel from this very place.
Who governs here?
A noble duke, in nature as in name.
And what is his name?
Orsino.
Orsino? I have heard my father name him. He was a bachelor then.
And so is now, or was so very late. For but a month ago I went from hence, and then 'twas fresh in murmur. As you know, what great ones do, the less will prattle of, that he did seek the love of fair Olivia.
What's she?
A virtuous maid, the daughter of a count that died some 12 months since, then leaving her in the protection of his son, her brother, who shortly also died, for whose dear love, they say, she hath abjured the company and sight of men.
So we find out that Olivia has actually had a double loss, her father and brother dead within a year. Shakespeare uses these shared circumstances to create a bond between the women, and Viola says,
"Oh, that I served that lady, and might not be delivered to the world till I had made mine own occasion mellow what my estate is."
Viola wishes she could work for Olivia because under her roof she could mourn her brother without the worry of how and where to live.
That were hard to compass.
Ooh, that won't be easy to make happen.
Because she will admit no kind of suit. No, not the Duke's.
Olivia has cut herself off and doesn't want anybody to approach her.
There is a fair behaviour in thee, Captain, and though that nature with a beauteous wall doth oft close in pollution, yet of thee I will believe thou hast a mind that suits with this thy fair and outward character. I prithee, and I'll pay thee bounteously, conceal me what I am, and be my aid for such disguise as haply shall become the form of my intent. I'll serve this Duke. Thou shalt present me as an eunuch to him.
Captain, she says, you may look a bit rough, but you're a good man, really. She offers to pay him if he'll help her into the Duke's household by disguising and presenting her as a eunuch. A boy singer whose voice hasn't broken, has his testicles cut off so it remains pure and high. The falsetto, it's called. In Italy, this tradition of boy singers being castrated was very popular. They were called castrati. For Viola, it was a great idea, as her voice could be a little girl-like, and she could get a job as a musician and singer at the court.
It may be worth thy pains, for I can sing and speak to him in many sorts of music that will allow me very worth his service. What else may hap, to time I will commit. Only shape thou thy silence to my wit.
And Viola ends with a clever rhyming couplet to let the tempo of the poetry show something exciting has been decided. And the captain immediately follows suit with his own rhyming couplet.
Be you his eunuch, and your mute I'll be. When my tongue blabs, then let mine eyes not see.
Oh, yuck! If he ever tells a secret, may his eyes be pulled out.
I thank thee. Lead me on.
And that ends scene two. Act one, scene three. Now we're inside Olivia's house for Sir Toby Belcher's grand entrance. He is Olivia's uncle. Sir Toby is in his element at this anarchic time. He is the Lord of Misrule. Critics over the years have suggested that he rules over an alternative court in this topsy-turvy world, when those who should otherwise wield their authority seem unable to do so. Orsino, for example, is laid low by love, and so Sir Toby has a free rein. With Sir Toby is Maria, Olivia's lady-in-waiting. She is small and feisty. And remember, she would have been played by a man. Up until now, Shakespeare has used blank verse, but now switches to prose, normal speech with no rhyme, which is unaccented and unstressed writing. You see, rhyme was seen as suitable for the high-ups in society, the lords and the courtiers, etc., not for the lower orders or for the mad or the drunk. So, even though Sir Toby is a nobleman, he is a reprobate, an old drunk, and he speaks prose. So, scene three opens with Sir Toby swigging from a bottle. He's already half drunk.
What a plague means my niece, to take the death of her brother thus. I'm sure care's an enemy to life.
Shakespeare immediately sums up Sir Toby. Fun is what life's all about. Worries and cares just get in the way. They are an enemy to life.
By my troth, Sir Toby, you must come in earlier o' nights. Your cousin, my lady, takes great exceptions to your ill hours.
Why, let her accept before accepted.
Aye, but you must confine yourself within the modest limits of order.
Confine? I'll confine myself no finer than I am. These clothes are good enough to drink in, and so be these boots too. And they be not, let them hang themselves in their own straps.
That quaffing and drinking will undo you. I heard my lady talk of it yesterday, and of a foolish knight that you brought in one night here to be her wooer.
Who? Sir Andrew Aguecheek?
And here we are introduced to the first of his drinking buddies, Sir Andrew Aguecheek. Now let me just tell you something about Aguecheek's name, as it alone would have got a big laugh from the audience. It may refer to the Spanish word aguachica, which means having a tiny wit, or to the fact that his cheek is eaten by disease, perhaps a reference to syphilis. Later in the play, we hear that he eats a great deal of beef, but he's normally played by very pale, thin, ill-looking actors. So his name is a double joke. He is rich because he can afford beef, but stupid, and may have an addled brain from syphilis.
Aye, he.
He's as tall a man as any's in Illyria.
What's that to the purpose?
Tall means respectable. And Maria cuts right to the point. What does it matter that he is respectable?
He has 3,000 ducats a year.
Ah, that's the point. He is rich, and Sir Toby can sponge off him. Sir Toby has little or no money of his own, so he lives off Olivia and any rich fool he can impress. With Sir Andrew, Toby is using Olivia as bait, telling Andrew she fancies him and he could get her to marry him while all the time he's spending his money for him.
Aye, but he'll have but a year in all these ducats. He's a very fool and a prodigal.
Well, that money won't last long. He's an idiot and a spendthrift. Prodigal means spendthrift.
Fie that you'll say so. He plays with the Valdegam boys and speaks three or four languages, word for word, without book, and hath all the good gifts of nature.
Well, Sir Toby realises that Maria is right, but he can't lose Sir Andrew. He needs the money, so he paints a picture of his friend as being a terrifically cultured man. The Viol de Gamboys was an early cello, not long invented and brought over from Italy, and rather fashionable to play at the time. Toby also says Andrew speaks several languages and is a great dancer.
He hath indeed almost natural, for besides that he's a fool, he's a great quarreller. And but that he hath the gift of a coward to allay the gust he hath in quarrelling, 'tis thought among the prudent he will quickly have the gift of a grave.
So Maria says he's a fool and a quarreller, meaning he likes to start fights with people, fights that in his day would have led to a duel. And if Sir Andrew were not such a coward, he'd have been killed in such a quarrel a long time before. This business about quarrelling was a mad fashion at the time. In Jonson's The Alchemist, for example, one character was a virtually professional quarreller. Books were written about how to quarrel, how to place a quarrel, how to use a sword in a quarrel, and what to say to people, how to flick your favours in their face, and so on. It was an inescapable part of being fashionable, to know how to quarrel.
By this hand, they are scoundrels and substractors that say so of him. Who are they?
They that add, moreover, he's drunk nightly in your company.
With drinking healths to my niece? I'll drink to her as long as there's a passage in my throat and drink in Illyria. He's a coward and a coistrel that will not drink to my niece.
Coistrel means knave, untrustworthy and disloyal.
Till his brains turn at the toe like a parish top. What, wench? Castigliano Vulgo. For here comes Sir Andrew Aguface.
Castigliano Vulgo. Be like a Spaniard, be haughty towards him. Sir Toby doesn't call him by his name, Aguecheek, but says Aguface. A crude joke for the audience because agua faccio means urinator or urination in Spanish. Sir Andrew enters and he looks like a prize idiot, stick thin, dressed in a most elaborate and colourful costume and wearing a wig. Instead of walking towards Sir Toby and Maria, he hollers his greeting across the stage.
Sir Toby Belch, how now, Sir Toby Belch?
Sweet Sir Andrew.
Bless you, fair shrew.
And you too, sir.
Accost, Sir Andrew. Accost.
What's that?
My niece's chambermaid.
Good mistress, accost. I desire better acquaintance.
Sir Toby is saying, get over here and talk to Maria. She's Olivia's chambermaid, and if you can impress her, then she will tell Olivia what a great guy you are. But Sir Andrew is so dumb, he thinks he's just been introduced to her as Mistress Acoste and is talking to her like she's a fellow noble. Of course, this further shows how dumb he is, because even though Maria would be presentable, she would be wearing servant clothes. By this, Shakespeare shows how in this court of misrule, governed by Sir Toby, that social status is swept away.
My name is Mary, sir.
A good Mistress Mary Accost.
You mistake, knight. Accost is front her, board her, woo her, assail her.
And the crowd would roar at this too, as Sir Toby means that he needs to get close to her to get close to Olivia. But Sir Andrew hears these as sexual references. He thinks Sir Toby is telling him to mount her here and now.
By my truth, I would not undertake her in this company. Is that the meaning of accost?
Well, I can't have sex with her here. Is that what accost means?
Fare you well, gentlemen.
Notice her use of you. This is less formal and polite than thou.
An thou let part so, Sir Andrew, would thou might never draw sword again.
And by sword he means penis. So he is telling Sir Andrew that he should make it clear to Maria that he won't make sexual advances to her ever again.
In you part so, mistress, I would I might never draw sword again. Fair lady, do you think you have fools in hand?
Sir, I have not you by the hand.
Marry, but you shall have, and here's my hand.
Now, sir, thought is free. I pray you, bring your hand to the buttery bar and let it drink.
The buttery bar is a serving hatch for drinks.
Wherefore, sweetheart? What's your metaphor?
It's dry, sir.
Another big laugh here, as the servant gets the better of the knight. She says his hand is dry, which for some reason was thought to indicate a weak and loveless nature.
Why, I think so. I am not such an ass, but I can keep my hand dry. But what's your jest?
A dry jest, sir.
Are you full of them?
Aye, sir. I have them at my fingers' ends. Marry, now I let go your hand, I am barren.
Having again outwitted Sir Andrew, Maria leaves.
Oh, knight, thou lack'st a cup of canary. When did I see thee so put down?
Never in your life, I think, unless you see canary put me down. Methinks sometimes I have no more wit than a Christian or an ordinary man has. But I am a greater eater of beef, and I believe that does harm to my wit.
After Maria put him down so easily, Sir Toby suggests that Andrew needs a drink. He agrees and begins to feel a bit sorry for himself. At the time, it was believed that beef could addle the brain, and he wonders if his foolishness stems from eating it.
No question.
And I thought that I'd forswear it. I'll go right home tomorrow, Sir Toby.
Pourquoi, my dear knight?
What is pourquoi? Do or not do? Oh.
This reveals one of the lies Sir Toby told earlier, that Sir Andrew spoke four languages. Well, he doesn't even know the simplest of French words. Even most of the audience would know pourquoi means why.
I would I had bestowed that time in the tongues that I have in fencing, dancing, and bear baiting.
Bear baiting was the disgusting public entertainment of tying a bear to a post and turning hungry dogs on him to see how long it took to be killed and how many dogs died in the process.
Oh, had I but followed the arts.
Then hadst thou had an excellent head of hair.
Of course, Sir Andrew is wearing a strange wig. This is further evidence of him having syphilis. Remember we said aguecheek meant he had a diseased cheek. Well, they treated syphilis at the time with a mercury unction, which meant all the hair fell out.
Why, would that have mended my hair?
Pass question, for thou seest it will not curl my nature.
But it becomes me well enough, dost not?
Excellent. It hangs like flax on a distaff, and I hope to see a housewife take thee between her legs and spin it off.
This is Sir Toby trying to rebuild the confidence Sir Andrew has just lost from teasing Maria. He's concerned about his hair, and Toby tells him it looks great. In fact, he's surprised every married woman around isn't trying to get him home for a night of passion.
Faith, I'll home tomorrow, Sir Toby. Your niece will not be seen, or if she be, it's 4-1, she'll none of me. The Count himself here hard by woos her.
Olivia is not interested in him. Andrew can't compete with Orsino, and so he's leaving.
She'll none of the Count. She'll not match above her degree, neither in estate, years, nor wit. I have heard her swear to it. There's life in it, man.
Don't give up.
I'll stay a month longer. I am a fellow of the strangest mind of the world. I delight in masks and revels, sometimes altogether.
Masks were mini plays, often short on plot, but high on lavish spectacle. And so perfect for the shallow Sir Andrew.
Art thou good at these kickshawses, knight?
Are you good at these elegant trifles, sir?
As any man in Illyria, whatsoever he be, under the degree of my betters, and yet I will not compare with an old man.
What is thy excellence in a galliard, knight?
The galliard is a fairly complicated dance, popular by the late 1500s. A lively dance in triple time with a terrific capering leap. Incidentally, a caper is a herb used in cookery, often eaten with lamb, hence this next joke.
Faith, I can cut a caper.
And I can cut the mutton to it.
Caper, mutton, get it?
And I think I have the back trick simply as strong as any man in Illyria.
Now, this backward dance step is essentially a reverse of the galliard, which required triple backward leaps. Oof, you had to mind the furniture. And Sir Andrew has mastered this. Again, a low form of physical entertainment, but it shows how agile he is.
Wherefore are these things hid? Wherefore have these gifts a curtain before them? Are they like to take dusk, like Mistress Marl's picture?
Now, this is a contemporary reference to a news story of the day and concerns Mary Moll Fitton, one of Elizabeth's maids of honour, who was disgraced by a scandalous love affair with Sir William Knowles, controller of the Queen's household, privy councillor and an MP. Anyhow, Mistress Moll's picture was taken down after her adulterous affair and hidden.
Why dost thou not go to church in a galliard and come home in a coranto?
A coranto is an energetic running dance.
My very walk should be a jig. I would not so much as make water but in a syncopace.
More crowd-pleasing jokes about urinating. Sir Toby means that even when he urinates, he does so in rhythm, in a five-step. Sank being French for five. Of course, he could also be saying that he urinates in a sink.
What does that mean? Is it a world to hide virtues in? I did think, by the excellent constitution of thy leg, it was formed under the star of a galliard.
Followers of Galileo, seeing the skies through telescopes, noticed that there were stars that seemed to move or dance. These were later discovered to be parts of double stars, but at the time it was thought if you were born under the astrological sign of a dancing star, it would have an effect upon your character.
It is strong, and it does indifferent well in a damned coloured stock. Shall we set about some revels?
What shall we do else? Were we not born under Taurus?
Taurus? That's sides and heart.
No, sir, it is legs and thighs. Let me see thee caper.
And Sir Toby wants to see him dance. So Sir Andrew dances and they go off like performing dog and master. Act 1, Scene 4. And we're going back to the main plot, as Viola is at the court of Duke Orsino, but now dressed as a man, a eunuch to be precise, by the name of Cesario. Okay, so Scene 4, a room at Orsino's palace, where Valentine is talking to Cesario, that's Viola in disguise.
If the Duke continue these favours towards you, Cesario, you are like to be much advanced. He hath known you but 3 days... and already you are no stranger.
So we have skipped forward in time, and Viola has been employed by Orsino and has worked there for 3 days. Already in that time, she has got close to Orsino. Now, I'll just remind you that early theatre was performed in real time, and the very idea of stage time deviating from this, shifting into the future, was revolutionary.
You either fear his humour or my negligence. That you call in question the continuance of his love. Is he inconstant, sir, in his favours?
So Valentine may be a little annoyed that he has been a loyal servant for years, and this upstart Cesario appears, and within 3 days is closer to the Duke than he is. So, Viola asks a plain question. Does the Duke have favourites and then drop them?
No, believe me.
But Valentine says no, the Duke doesn't just drop people. So we immediately know that Orsino has seen something in Cesario, a sexual attraction that Orsino won't act on because he believes Cesario is a man.
I thank you. Here comes the Count.
Now Valentine and Viola are joined by Duke Orsino, Curio and attendants.
Who saw Cesario home?
On your attendants, my lord, here.
Stand you a while aloof.
So he sends Valentine and the others off into the corner, and he wants to talk with Cesario alone. Orsino is far more relaxed with Cesario than his other staff.
Cesario, thou knowest no less but all. I have unclasped to thee the book even of my secret soul.
In the last 3 days, Orsino has told this boy all about his love for Olivia.
Therefore, good youth, address thy gate unto her. Be not denied access, stand at her doors, and tell them there thy fixed foot shall grow till thou have audience.
Orsino wants Cesario to go and see Olivia and tell her of his love. Cesario, also known as Viola, must see her, and if she refuses, must just stand there until she changes her mind.
Sure, my noble lord. If she be so abandoned to her sorrow as it is spoke, she never will admit me.
Well, Viola thinks it's a lost cause, but Orsino won't hear of it.
Be clamorous, and leap all civil bounds, rather than make unprofited return.
Say I do speak with her, my lord. What then?
Oh, then unfold the passion of my love. Surprise her with discourse of my dear faith. It shall become thee well to act my woes. She will attend it better in thy youth than in a nuncio's of more grave aspect.
A nuncio is a messenger. Orsino hopes that Olivia will respond more positively to his advances if he sends someone closer to her own age.
I think not so, my lord.
Dear lad, believe it, for they shall yet belie thy happy years that say thou art a man.
Ah, the irony. Orsino has no idea that he is a she.
Diana's lip is not more smooth and rubious. Thy small pipe is as the maiden's organ, shrill and sound, and all is semblative a woman's part. I know thy constellation is right apt for this affair.
Your lips are red like a woman's, and your small pipe, or voice, is like a woman's too. You're perfect for the job.
Some 4 or 5 attend him. All, if you will. For I myself am best when least in company.
Orsino then slips back into his melancholy, saying how he likes to have few people around. Oh, but then as Viola moves off to see Olivia, Orsino beckons her back and whispers in her ear.
Prosper well in this, and thou shalt live as freely as thy lord to call his fortunes thine.
Get me Olivia, and I'll make it worth your while.
I'll do my best. To woo your lady.
And then she turns to the audience and says,
yet a baffled strife. Whoe'er I woo, myself would be his wife.
She will woo Olivia on his behalf, but now she finds she's fallen in love with him herself. Act 1, Scene 5, A Room in Olivia's House. Mariah enters with Feste, a jester or fool, who worked for her father and now works for her. Shakespeare often uses the character of a fool in his plays. In Hamlet, for example, the role has been described as the play's conscience. Twelfth Night's fool, Feste, is the most rounded and interesting of all Shakespeare's fools. He has freedom to move between Olivia's house and Orsino's court, and his wisdom and observation often anchors the play, underpinning its humour and its sadness, acting as a counterpoint to the hysteria of the topsy-turvy world of the play. Shakespeare wrote the character for his top comedy performer, Robert Armin, who was very particular about his roles, and his popularity meant that he wielded some power. He insisted that Feste sang every song, which is why Viola, who joined Orsino's court as a castrati, or singing eunuch, never sings a note. He also quarrelled with Shakespeare about some of the action later in the play, and as a result the character of Fabian was introduced to take the lines he didn't want.
Nay, either tell me where thou hast been, or I will not open my lips so wide as a bristle may enter in way of thy excuse. Ooh. My lady will hang thee for thy absence.
Let her hang me. He that is well hanged in this world needs to fear no colours.
That's Feste in a nutshell. On the face of it, he makes the crude remark that a man who is well hung or sexually well endowed has little to fear. But there's more to it than that, because the image of the hanged man is a profound symbol that can be traced to early mythology. From Odin, who in Norse legend hanged himself upside down from the tree of life to gain enlightenment, to Osiris in Egyptian legend, to Mithras in Roman mythology, and to St. Peter in Christianity. In all of these traditions and beliefs, the hanged man is often seen as a fool.